Hello, everyone, and welcome to the third podcast in this series. I have now given the podcast a name, as you may have noticed. It's now called History and Stuff. Maybe I'll change it later again, but I think that's a better name than just having no name, at least. So today, as you may have noticed, if you follow me on social media, I have a guest to today's episode. And this episode is going to be on political violence in Sweden, and we're going to start counting about 1990, and we're going to focus on far-right violence. So without further ado, I would like to welcome Todd Ulf.
Thank you. Thank you very much. All right. You have been on my podcast before, so...
Yeah, I was on your podcast. We discussed Egyptian history a bit.
Yeah.
This history is a lot more modern, but I think this will work well anyway.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
So let's get started, I guess.
Yes. We're going to start in about 100 years ago, because I want to give some background on some political violence that happened in Sweden before this period. So there hasn't really been a lot of political violence in Sweden throughout the 20th century. Sweden avoided both world wars, and the period of sort of bombings and hijackings and kidnappings didn't really hit Sweden as it hit other parts of Europe. As you may know, there was a time not that long ago, in like the 60s to 80s, where a lot of terrorist attacks happened quite frequently in a lot of different places. You had groups like ETA, IRA, UVF, the Red Army faction in Germany, and then you had the Red Brigades in Italy, and you also have PFLP. Doing actions in Europe, and a lot of things happened during this time, and there were a lot of bombings by these separatist groups or left-wing groups that sort of, there was a lot of political violence at this time. In Sweden, this really didn't happen that much. There was an RAF attack against the West German embassy in 1975, but these sort of events have been very much the exception rather than the rule, and Sweden has been, you know, quite calm when it comes to political violence 20th century.
Yeah, we should also note that the attack at the West German embassy is the reason the Swedish police reformed and modernized to the organizations we have today. It's the first time we got slightly militarized weaponry tactics into the police.
Yeah, it was kind of a meme for a while that Swedish police was very, you know, incompetent, and that they weren't very good at dealing with, you know, live shooting situations. I remember at Norrmalmstorgs dramas as well, people were like reading newspapers who were supposed to sort of watch out for, you know, keep check on the areas. And there wasn't really an organization to deal with those kinds of situations.
Yeah, the funny story is my dad was there, by the way, which is kind of interesting. he's told me a little bit about it. But basically, Sweden didn't have a use for a militarized police before. We didn't need, you know, SWAT teams and stuff like. But at the end of the 1900s here, we clearly shown that we do need them still.
Yeah, because some stuff that did happen throughout the 19th century in. As early as 1908, we had what was called the Amalthea bombing. Yep. It was a bombing against a ship full with strike breakers from Britain and a bunch of young socialists wanted basically to scare them. They didn't actually mean to kill anyone, but they ended up killing a worker. And this was, you know, a big deal, because these sort of things didn't really happen that often, that, you know, people died in a political attack. And the people who did this, they were sentenced to death, actually, even though in 1908, Sweden had basically stopped executing people. And the death penalty was also, it was abolished before they were executed. And the people who did it later got pardoned. And Anton Nilsson, who was sort of the main guy who did it, he ended up having quite a successful career after this as well. There was also some anti-socialist violence in the early 1900s. Most notably, we had the burning of the socialist newspaper Norrskensflamman, the flame of the northern lights, would be the sort of translation. And it killed 5 people, including 2 children. And 5 people is still the most deadly terrorist attack in Swedish history, basically.
Yeah, we should note with that event that they basically torched someone's home. So, because they lived where the paper was made. So it's both a terrorist attack against the newspaper and, you know, just legit murder.
Yeah, just straight up murder. And one of the very, very sort of suspicious things was that the people who did it, they weren't charged with murder. They were just charged with property damage, which may seem a bit odd when, you know, they burnt a house where they know people live.
They kind of had to know that they were living there. I think they lived on the upper floor of the house. So basically they knew what they were doing and didn't get caught for it or sentenced for it.
Yeah, I think they got... they got some sentences, but it was very, very short.
Yeah.
Yeah, like if you burned an empty house, that would be basically the punishment they got. And during this time, it was in 1940, I think, and it was the Winter War. So all the anti-communists were very, very active. And they were very, very strong anti-communist sentiments at the time.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and I wanted to mention this just short because I didn't know about it, but apparently there was also a plane hijacking in Sweden in the 1970s by Croatian nationalists. I think they were sort of Ustaše, sort of neo-fascist, sort of in that political direction. And no one died, which a lot of hijackings in the 70s, there were just a lot of plane hijackings where no one got hurt or very few people got hurt, and people just hijacked planes. I didn't know about this.
Yeah, I didn't know about that attack either. That's kind of...
And we're like both very history interested people.
Yeah.
So I was like, did I miss a plane hijacking?
Yeah.
By like Croatian,
And Croatian nationalists in Sweden. What the fuck?
Yeah, and apparently they also killed the ambassador like the year before. Also Croatian nationalists. They killed the Yugoslav ambassador to Sweden.
Also, we should mention that when a West German ambassador was attacked, we should note that one of Sweden's biggest punk rock bands is named after the operation.
That's Ebba Grön, right?
Yeah. Because they had two, they were going to storm the building. And basically what they did was they had Ebba Grön, which means green light, Ebba Green, and Ebba Grön, that the operation had red light. So basically they screened over the police radio, they screened Ebba Grön, and that is the name of the punk band, which is kind of funny.
And I'm going to move on a bit now. If you look at more present day focus on the sort of political discussion, it has probably been more on Islamic extremism, more than right-wing or left-wing terrorism. And there has been a few attacks. In 2010, there was a suicide attack in central Stockholm carried out by an Islamist. He didn't manage to actually kill anyone or hurt anyone except himself, and he died, but no one really got seriously injured. Yeah. It could have been a lot worse, but he didn't... his bomb creation was really bad, so he only managed to kill himself.
Yeah, basically what happened was that he tried to set it off in the middle of the street, and it failed to ignite, which he then went into some kind of alley and stood by himself, and then it exploded. So,
yeah.
Also, he stole a car in my town to go to Stockholm.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
That's such a weird detail that I found about when it happened, because our car salesman had lost the car, and then he got a call, Stockholm attack of 2010. Like, yeah, okay.
Yeah. And there has also been about, I think, 300 people who had traveled from Sweden to Syria and Iraq to fight for various groups. Some people have traveled to fight for Rojava or sort of other groups like that. And a lot of people have also traveled to fight for ISIS or the Al-Nusra Front or Al-Qaeda aligned groups. So there's a lot of discussion in Sweden, like, oh, what to do with these people, because you could sort of deduct that they have committed crimes, but you don't really know exactly what. So how are you going to punish them? That has been a large topic of discussion. And yeah, and in 2017, we also had an attack in the same area as the first one was attempted. But this one was sadly more successful. And he rammed a semi-truck into a street full of people and killed five people. And it also is the tied with the Norrskensflamman burning, with the sort of most lethal terrorist attack in Swedish history. So there has also been a sort of Islamist activity in recent years. Sort of left-wing extremism hasn't really had any sort of fatal outcome of any of the events, so I'm not going to mention them very much. Sort of whenever something happens with the left-wing extremists, they tend to mainly stick to fighting the right-wing extremists, which isn't true for Islamists or the far right. They tend to target, like, everyday people.
I think the closest one to left-wing extremism attack would be Shadetorp.
Yeah, like there was a left-wing guy who stabbed a Nazi, and he got pretty seriously injured. But he was sort of attacked by Nazis first.
Yeah, he was. They were attacked by with Nazis armed with flagpoles. Like, that's a very common tactic here, is that the Nazis have their flags, use them as kind of spears, as a weapon. That's what happened here, and he retaliated. I should say retaliated, because I don't think it's self-defense when you stab someone in the back like that.
He didn't have to. I've seen the video. He was kind of lunging at him when he had sort of backed off. It was still a violent event.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest one, actually.
Yeah, in recent times, at least.
At least in recent times.
Yes. However, when you actually look at sort of deaths that has had sort of a political leaning, There have been basically all of them, except for the ones I mentioned before, by Rakhmat Akilov, all of them have been perpetrated by far-right extremists. And I don't know the count, what the count is up to today, but I know that between the year 1999, I think, and 2009, at least 14 people were killed by far-right extremists. And during the 1990s, there started like a skinhead movement in Sweden, like late 80s, really. And they started organizations like White Aryan Resistance, and some groups that wasn't like open Nazis, but were still very, very racist. Like they tried to start a party called the Sweden Party, for example. And the party, the Sweden Democrats, was also formed in like the late 80s, early 90s, somewhere around that. And a lot of the sort of core people were from earlier parties that had been explicitly basically Nazi parties or nationalist parties.
Yeah, they kind of mimic the left of the early 1900s in how they split like atoms and form new parties everywhere, but it's always the same core people. So you can kind of track them that way.
And I looked up, like, later we're going to bring up an organization called Nordic Resistance Movement.
Yep.
And they have split again, like, recently, but it's, like, still the same people. They don't get anyone new. It's still, like, the same core of people. In all these organizations, basically.
Yeah, that's how we are able to kind of catalog them in a way that is, you know, actually make some kind of biography on each and every one of them, because they have usually a pretty long history within the movement, and they are always in conflict with each other, so they kind of break it out as well. So it's not like to find the connections. We just have to look at their Twitter, who they are fighting with right now, and we can find the rest of the organization, basically. It's they usually, far-right movements in Sweden usually say that the government cracked down on them, but I would like to add that they kind of cracked down on themselves. That split. so that's why we got, you know, you got some more extreme people that split with the not that extreme people, and that little group, the new little group, are usually the one doing different attacks under a new name. It's its own political landscape.
Yes, and I just want to mention too that the first leader of the Sweden Democrats, that guy was connected to what's called the Nordic Rikspartiet, which was basically an older generation of sort of national socialist parties in Sweden. And one of the sort of early local parties also had a member of the board who was a previous Waffen-SS volunteer. So he was unambiguously a Nazi, because he actually fought in Germany for the Nazis in World War II. So that's not very good.
It's kind of hard to, you know, explain that one.
Sometimes you get people who insist that only people who was in World War II in Germany are Nazis. Well, even by that definition, that guy was a Nazi. And the sort of Sweden Democrats, they never claimed sort of open Nazi ideas. And their idea was basically, okay, we're going to tone down this stuff that isn't really popular, like anti-Semitism and sort of violent street movement things, and we're going to focus just on immigration. And it has kind of worked pretty well. And the party is hovering around 20% support, sometimes a little less, sometimes a little more, in sort of in polls today. And I should also say that, like, Sweden Democrats don't really, like, they don't have a paramilitary movement. They're not themselves sort of violent, a violent party in this, like, the earlier far-right parties had, like, you know, a more organized, violent part. The Sweden Democrats don't really.
Yeah, but they all just, like, yesterday proposed force that is less educated than the actual police force and give them weapons in order to maintain control. And while that police force wouldn't be, you know, directly connected to the party, it sounds a little bit like a Freikorps kind of idea.
Yeah, I saw that too, yeah.
Yeah.
They don't have a shortage of people who have those kinds of ideas.
Yeah.
So if we move a step back to, like, the Nazi parties of the 1990s and the sort of Nazi movement, you had a lot of people who gathered there who were very much willing and able to commit violence for the cause. A lot of them were already criminals and had engaged in violent crimes even before they joined the movement. And there was a number of attacks in the 1990s where Nazis would basically in-group attack someone. And it was often unprovoked and just picking out people who they thought, oh, that guy's an immigrant, or, you know, that guy's gay, or things like that. So it was usually, like, for the people who were attacked, it seemed very random.
Yeah, but the Nazi movement during the 90s was really strong in Sweden. Like, I don't know if everyone understood that they were Nazis, but the kind of the skinhead culture overall was really alive in the 90s in Sweden.
You could hear people say, no, they're not really Nazis, they're just confused and things like that.
Yeah, a lot of that going around. But even where I live, in the small towns of Östergötland, we had a lot of skinhead Nazis. It's like, I don't know, the movement was very, and they were very open with it, like, you know, American History X open. So they weren't, you know, ashamed of being Nazis either. They were kind of openly displaying it.
Yeah, and even in, like, I've been reacting a bit to, like, American news that they say, oh, it's a big news story that there is, like, Nazi propaganda being posted up here or there. And I feel like, yeah, but in every small town in Sweden, like, there are Nazi flyers, there are Nazi stickers. It isn't really, like, open Nazis put these up everywhere. And it's that kind of propaganda has been here for a long time.
Yeah, I've gotten personalized propaganda mail. So, like, we even have a sort of, what do you call it, like a battle group of the Nordic resistance movement right here in my town. I don't know how many there are, maybe, but, you know, it's still there.
Yeah. And I'll just take up a few examples of events that happened in the 90s. There was an asylum seeker from the Ivory Coast that was attacked by a group of Nazis and beaten to death in an assault. He had no idea who they were. They just attacked him because he was an immigrant. And there was also a very high-profile murder of a 14-year-old boy who was called Jean Ron, who were beaten to death by a group of Nazis. And they were basically his bullies from school, but they weren't, you know, Nazis, and they attacked him. And, you know, very in a very, very brutal way, beat him to death. And, yeah, that was...
And the murderers were also kids. It was like kid on kid violence. I think there is only one of them that actually like made Nazism his main cause, I think, but for the murder, because he told him. He told Jan Roon to confess to Nazism, or they would kill him, which he refused to do, and then they killed him and threw him in the lake, which is why that case got so high profile. Because it was, you know, people up to that point did not realize that Nazis were an actual problem. Like, you had... In the 90s, you had parents that had children that were skinhead Nazis, and they were like, yeah, it's just a face, it's just blah, blah, blah. I think that is the first time that people realized that, shit, my son might be a Nazi, and that is not good. Because it kind of, we didn't really process it before it.
Yeah, and there is also, I think, kind of a self-image, at least in parts of Sweden, that were, you know, there basically exist. Racism really doesn't exist here, and so seeing a bunch of, you know, admitting that you have a Nazi problem is kind of uncomfortable, and so you just call them confused kids.
But we do have a serious Nazi problem. That's his.
Yeah. And there was also a murder of an ice hockey player, quite high up in the sort of Isiris system, who was killed because of his sexual orientation. He was gay, so that those gay people were also targets of the Nazi movement at the time, and he was stabbed to death by a Nazi.
Yeah,
also true. In the 90s. And these attacks I've talked about were kind of, they were not very, excuse the word, but they weren't very sort of professional. They were attacks usually by quite young Nazis, and they weren't really, you know, pretty much every one of these people got caught pretty fast, I think. And they weren't very subtle about it. There was also like more organized violence on a few occasions. For example, the murder of Björn Söderberg, where he was attacked by a group of Nazis, specifically for his political orientation and his political stances. He was a syndicalist, a union organizer, basically. And he found out that one of the sort of union representatives were a Nazi. So they wanted to attack him for revealing that they were he was a Nazi, basically. And he was shot outside his apartment. And he was, like, ambushed.
Yeah, they basically executed. And one of the murderers are on Twitter right now, and I'm not going to name his name because I'm not going to do that, but he's kind of, people seem to have kind of forgotten what he's done.
Yeah. And yeah, because Sweden has, especially for sort of young perpetrators, Sweden has kind of, don't have that long prison sentences. So a lot of these people are, you know, out and about today. Some of them still very much active Nazis. even if they were convicted.
Yeah, and we should also say that, we don't have specific laws against political murders. Like,
yeah, it's just treated as a basically.
It's murder.
It's murder. Yeah.
It's not, you know, you don't get to add the part of it to the sentence. So they can't be realistically sentenced to a harsher punishment. So if they are younger, they will get a lighter sentence, and then they will be out for like good behavior or something like that. And there's nothing we can do realistically about it in the court of law right now without, you know, the law actually changing on that.
Yeah. Yes. And if we sort of move away a bit from the organized neo-Nazi movement, we also had a few what would be called lone wolves, even if I don't agree with that term. A number of people who had far-right ideas and anti-immigrant ideas that also carried out violence. Most famously, we had someone who was called Lasermannen, or the laser man, because he had a laser sight on his rifle, at least at a few of the shootings. And he shot 11 people. I think one of them died. It could possibly be more, but I think he got caught for 11 of them. And all of the victims were of dark complexion. And so he just, once again, he didn't know them. He picked them out because he thought they were immigrants and shot them. The guy who did it was called John Ausonius. And this caused a lot of fear in Sweden, because this was also like, he wasn't caught for a good while, and people knew that these attacks were going on. So it caused a lot of fear. I'm not old enough to remember it, but there was a lot of newspaper headlines, and people tend to remember it because, you know, there was a fear of, you know, if you see a laser sight, throw yourself, run away and try to escape.
And he hasn't really said a lot about it either, which is kind of eerily creepy to me, because he's kind of, whenever he's interviewed, he's not, expressing his, you know, Nazi beliefs or whatever. And he kind of don't want to talk about it in a way, because he wants to always paint himself in a better light. But dude, that's not going to happen, because we know what you did. And that was vicious.
Yeah.
Like, that is vicious.
And it's also like, he didn't just snap one time. He planned it, and he did it again, and he did it again.
I'm pretty sure also he took a hunter's exam to get a hold of rifles. Because logistically, being a sniper, vigilante sniper in Sweden is kind of hard without a license. And he didn't use, you know, a wartime weapon. The hunter rifles, I think. That case is really just weird, straight up weird. The person is weird as well.
Yeah, and I think he's in for life, right?
Yeah, he's in for life.
I don't
think that he will ever get out. To explain that, Sweden has a life sentence that is usually 15 to 21 years. Then your case gets tried in court to see. We have several, but by law, the life sentence is actually life. But we have, you know, so some people will not get out. And I'm pretty sure that, you know, so yeah, he's not going to get out.
He probably sort of the least likely one I can think of. Except for Akilov, they were probably staying. Yeah,
it's Akilov.
Yeah, him too. Yeah,
like these people are not getting out. They might get out when they're too old to actually do anything.
Yeah.
Like that's how our court system works, basically.
Yes. So it's basically the opposite of Norway, where they don't have the life in prison, but in practice they do, because Breivik. Yeah. So they decided, yeah, we have to keep him locked up. So they changed the law.
Yeah, because usually when it comes to if you want someone to actually never get out, not ever, you usually send them to the psychiatric ward for the criminal insane. But none of these people are insane, which is why it's so scary, because they did these acts without being insane, which means that they are somehow, you know, they are somehow rational, and they still did it.
Yes, and then we also had a car bombing in the late 90s, I think it was 99, of a journalist who was known for attacking Nazis and making investigative stories about Nazis. And both he and his son were quite severely injured. And no one was ever caught for this, but the sort of the speculation and the sort of main line of the investigation was that the Nazis basically had conducted this attack. And Nazis using bombs isn't unheard of either. It has happened several times.
Yeah, they like bombs.
Yes. And then we'll move on to probably maybe the most spectacular, maybe, except for Lasermannen, of the sort of Nazi events of the 90s. I think it still was the 90s. With a number of robberies eventually a shootout with police that ended up with the death of two police officers in the small town of Malexander. And even today, if you say Malexander in Sweden, people know you're like, that's the place where, you know, the Nazis killed the police. It's still very much these kind of things are not very common in Sweden. So it gained a lot of attention. And sort of these robberies and eventually the shootout were carried out by three individuals who had a small neo-Nazi organization called the NRA, or the National Republican Army. And I think the police don't really think that this was really an organization, like an army style. It was just, you know, the name these people put on themselves and maybe a few other people. But it wasn't actually like a big Nazi movement.
It's probably, I think... They kind of formed it inside prison. So there were a few people involved in it. But they weren't the Nordic resistance movement in like actually being a political force.
Yeah. But they were quite good at it, like doing robberies and stuff. They were quite effective criminals, which was also why it sort of took a while before they got caught, and why, you know, it ended like it did. Basically the main event happened when they tried to rob a bank in a small town in a town called Kisa, and they had already robbed a series of banks, and they were heavily armed and managed to get 2.6 million kroner, which is basically, if you want to know what that is in euro, you basically just take away a zero, so it's 260,000 euro, basically. So they were chased down by a police officer who was on his own. And they started opening fire on him. because they were armed with submachine guns, I think. And he started throwing hand grenades at him as well, which, you know, that wasn't something the average Swedish cop was very used to. So the guy chasing them basically gave up and said, okay, they're going to shoot me. I'm going to stay here, and I'm going to call for backup. So that's what he did. Two other police officers showed up and started chasing them in the car. And they were met with heavy gunfire. And basically, all the cars stopped. And there was a big shootout. And the police officers were hit. And they were both killed. Like, up close shot. Execution style. And all three of these robbers were caught after a few days. One of them even managed to flee to, I think, Costa Rica, but it was a country in the Caribbean or Central America. But he was extradited shortly after. So, like, a sort of double homicide of police officers by a Nazi group, like, that had never happened before. So this was quite sensational. And the people who were involved in this had also done a bunch of other things before. Most prominently, maybe Jacky Arklöv. He had already been convicted of war crimes because he had fought in Bosnia on the side of the Croats in the Yugoslav wars. And he claimed later that basically he thought that side was closest to his values as, you know, a National Socialist. And I think he joined like a Ustasha group in Bosnia as well. So he had, you know, a very violent past, and he was not unused to shooting people. And it's probably that guy who ended up killing the two police officers, although, you know, we can never be entirely sure.
And I think all three were eventually convicted of the murders, right? They couldn't decide which person did what, really. But
yeah, that's another idea of Swedish law, right? That you can be convicted even if they know that you weren't the guy or girl actually doing the killing. But if you knew that, you know, there was gonna be killing, and, you know, your buddy does it, you can still be convicted of murder. Not just assistance, but murder.
Yeah.
So I think they're in for life as well. At least Arklöv. I don't really know about the other two.
The other two has tried to appeal a couple of times, but been denied. So I think they're pretty much not going to get out either.
No, it doesn't seem likely. And especially since, you know, this is still probably the most famous, like, neo-Nazi action throughout Swedish history. So it wouldn't be popular if they were let out. There was also a lot of criticism after this, because it turned out that, like, one of the people was, like, on parole while he was doing a bunch of robberies, but he was doing it, like, on his leave days when he wasn't in prison, and then he would go back to prison, and then the next leave he would do more robberies. So the police was very much criticized for basically not having control of these people.
Yeah.
Yeah. And another detail that I thought I might mention is that Jacky Arklöv was maybe not the guy who you thought would end up as a neo-Nazi because he was black. His mother came from Liberia, and he was adopted to Sweden. So, like, he had a difficult time, like, getting into the group at first because, you know, there were Nazis who weren't very happy with, you know, a dark-skinned guy joining their group. Yeah, but I guess since he had been in Bosnia, and, like, you know, he already he knew how to do stuff.
Yeah.
And he was very, very much committed to the cause.
Yeah, I think it still is. It's not like he regrets what he did. So
interviews where he would, at first he would like refuse to say who did it, and he would say that, you know, my comrades, you don't tell on your comrades, like, yeah. And he very much still talked.
Yeah.
Talk the talk, at least.
Yeah.
So that's a very odd story. So if we move on a bit, we'll start to move into one decade ago, in around 2009-2010. A very familiar pattern started to appear, a very ominous pattern. There was a bunch of shootings against basically random people that didn't seem to connect to anything. At first, they thought it was, you know, organized crime, gang violence, things like that. But after a while, they realized none of these people were connected to that. And all they had in common was basically they were, or they seemed to be, immigrants. They had sort of darker skin. There continued to be a bunch of shootings of seemingly random people in the Swedish town called Malmö, or city, in southern Sweden.
I think Malmö is famous in USA right now.
Okay. Yeah, it gets talked about a lot. Yeah, and people started to call him, you know, the new laser man, or Nya Lasermannen, because it seemed very like what had happened before with Lasermannen, because he attacked immigrants. But I don't think he used a laser sight. And he was found out to be a man called Peter Mangs. And he was also convicted of another murder that happened, I think, in 2003. And he was also like found to have targeted and based on the ethnicity of the people. There is a book based on interviews with him called The Race Warrior. Sort of the violence from neo-Nazi groups and neo-Nazi individuals have also happened in our neighboring Nordic countries. Although it should be said that, like, the organized Nazi movement is still stronger in Sweden than in Denmark or Finland or Norway. But that's maybe just because we're many more people.
Yeah, also I would like to say that most of the other organizations in the other countries kind of evolve from here, so to speak. Like the Swedish organizations are creating organizations in the other countries for them to join.
Like the Swedish movement is like, that's where all the veterans, quote unquote, are. And so they're the most organized. And it used to be like, there used to be a Swedish resistance movement and a Norwegian resistance movement and a Danish resistance movement. But then they just, you know, they put them all together and now they just call themselves the Nordic resistance movement.
Yep.
Because there weren't enough people, basically, in the other countries to keep the organization alive. But probably the most violent far-right attack, like, since Timothy McVeigh or something like that, was in 2011, where a far-right extremist attacked government buildings in Oslo, as well as a political youth camp for the Social Democratic Party in Norway. And I think, I don't really remember exactly the number, but it was over 70 people who died.
Yeah.
And it's, I think, the most deadly act since World War II in the Nordic countries, basically.
Yeah.
And he was maybe the earliest example I can think of someone who was like online radicalized in the way we know today.
Yeah, pretty much. I want to speak. He's one of the first ones that do an act under the banner of Deus Vult as well. Like as he thought that he was a part of some kind of crusade. And his manifesto is, it's very confused, but it still holds the thread that he sees himself as a crusader rather than a Nazi. And I think we're going to stumble upon that a little bit later in the pod here, because that is a fairly new idea, like, yeah. In a way.
Yeah, I think that was at the very beginning, after they know who he was, like, I think people didn't really say, oh, guy, this guy's a far-right extremist, because...
Yeah, and he had his own, like, idea of... a knightly order, so to speak. So like a, well, the German Crusader Knights, something like that.
Yeah, and he talked a lot about what was called Eurabia. I don't really think people talked about it anymore, because now they call it the Great Replacement.
Yeah.
But it was basically an idea that Arabs are moving into Europe in order to take it over and make it a part of the Arab world through, you know, moving in and breeding. And this sort of idea is, it has disturbingly, you know, it's quite popular, unfortunately, in like conspiracy theory movements, and also like more mainstream people. I think, for example, Sam Harris, he recommended the book Eurabia,
which
and he hasn't removed it from his website, which I really think he should.
There is a lot of things that Sam Harris should do, like maybe do a podcast where he just, you know, apologizes for all the shit he has caused. But also, yeah, remove that book, for God's sake.
It's like, yeah,
we're gonna talk a little bit more about online radicalization soon, I think. So I'm gonna save some of it.
Yeah, but we're gonna move on to Finland, which generally hasn't been there. Hasn't really been a lot of neo-Nazi movement in Finland that I know of. But in 2016, the Nordic Resistance Movement had basically a demonstration, I think, and they attacked a man who sort of, I don't know really why, I think he, you know, told them to piss off or something, and they attacked him and kicked him and basically assaulted him until the point that he died a few days later. This guy in Finland that was murdered, Finland basically decided to treat the Nordic Resistance Movement as basically as a terrorist group, like it was illegal to be a member, and the organization was banned pretty shortly after this event. And the Nordic Resistance Movement isn't banned in Sweden. I don't think they're banned in Norway or Denmark either.
No, it's only Finland. But I think the problem is that Swedish law doesn't really allow us to do it. Because if we were to do it, we need to change the law about the right to organize.
And you'd likely also get people trying to ban sort of communist parties and things like that. If they say, you know, we want revolution, how do you treat a party that in theory wants revolution, but, you know, mostly they just hand out flyers? Should you really treat them as terrorists? I don't really think so, even if they're, you know, Nazis.
Yeah.
And so NMR, which is the organization we're talking about here, they have also established like a base of operations in Dalarna, a sort of area of Sweden where they have, you know, they don't really have that much support, but they basically all moved to one area so they could like try to get one or two seats in the municipal council.
We should also probably say that Dalarna has a kind of historical meaning due to uprisings in Sweden. So
yeah, and it's also like the idea of Swedish midsommar. It also comes from Dalarna.
Yeah.
So it's like yeah.
It's a deliberate choice. Is what I'm trying to say. Like it's not random. It's just.
Yeah.
They're trying to put themselves in the shoes of the uprisings in Dalarna against like Gustav Vasa and stuff like that, because that puts them in the revolutionary, their revolutionary ideas and stuff like that. So I think it's pretty deliberate that they focus their energy there, rather than anywhere else, because there is not a lot of, you know, gang crime happening in Dalarna.
Yeah.
So if they were, you know, true to their thing about immigrants and gangs or whatever, they wouldn't seat there. They would focus anywhere else. But
yeah. And for a while, they actually got one representative in the sort of municipal council. They didn't get it through votes. They got it by basically hijacking a seat, which you can do in Sweden if the party doesn't say, okay, only these people can run for my party, but they basically, some parties allow everyone to run for their party. So I think it was the Sweden Democrats. They didn't have enough people to fill out their seats, so it got to one of the, you know, the Nazi party.
Interesting note on that. That also happened in Lidköping, in which Kurt Linesson, who had the paramilitary group Pluton Svea outside with Västergötland, where the cops took it. Kurt Linesson is an old officer that was in the peacekeeping troops from Sweden in Bosnia. He's a Nazi, by the way. But basically what he did was that people took a Sweden Democrat ballot and wrote his name on it. So he got into the municipality council. And this is a military Nazi, basically. I don't think he has a seat anymore, but he had it for, you know, the 4 years or whatever.
Yeah, and this is basically the only way that these sort of Nazi parties has had any seats. Yeah. Basically hijacking them and running in areas where, you know, there are very few people. So a very few votes still gets you a seat.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, when they were, I don't think they're even in Ludvika anymore. I think they lost the seat. But they had a sort of history of photographing people going in and out of the sort of buildings, and they were very threatening.
Yeah, also in Ludvika specifically, they had this manifestation. There was a rape case, I think, of a young girl, and they had a manifestation, use her name in the manifestation, against her dad's will, I think. And basically, I think that kind of sorted them out, because no one in that town wanted to, you know, vote for people that used the faith of an innocent girl to run their city. So basically, yeah, they are very good at, you know, screwing themselves over in that case.
I also think that it was another party that was also a Nazi party called the Swedes Party, they don't exist anymore, but they existed for a while. They also got a sort of a hijack seat, but they couldn't. They couldn't actually claim the seat because no one who was running actually lived in that area. So they didn't even bother to sort of register in that area. So they lost that seat as well.
Yeah.
So they're not always that very good at running a political organization.
I think that Sweden Democrats still have problems to fill their seats.
Yeah.
Like there are so many chairs empty around the country.
It's yeah. Like, so people like take local celebrities and basically take their ballot and write in a celebrity. I think Thomas Wassberg was elected, even though he didn't run. So he didn't take the seat, but he could have. Because basically there are a lot of people who want to vote for the Sweden Democrats who don't want to represent them. So, yeah.
Yeah, we had a problem in... not in my town of Vadstena, but in Motala. I think both representatives of the Sweden Democrats had jumped off. So yeah. they had two seats, but they have no one representing those seats.
Yeah. So just, they have also lost a number of like of parliament seats because a group of the Sweden Democrats basically defected and created a party of their own that lost the election, so they lost their seats, but they had a few seats for a while. So there's a lot of infighting there. And then we go back to what we mentioned before shortly, which was a demonstration against neo-Nazi activity in Kärrtorp, which is an area in Stockholm. And this resulted in a clash between a number of NMR, and so Nordic Resistance Movement attackers. I don't really know how many they were, maybe 20, 30, something like that.
Yeah, something like that, armed with flagpoles, I think.
Yeah, armed with flagpoles, and they basically attacked the demonstration, which it wasn't like, it was a quite small demonstration, I think, so there weren't very many cops there. I think like 4 or 5, something.
Yeah,
like
and most of the participants were just regular, you know, families.
Pensioners, children.
Yeah, and what happened was basically that a neo-Nazi group attacked the demonstration, and a black bloc of anarchists turned up and to defend the demonstration, basically.
Yeah.
And tried to fight the Nazis off, which resulted in some sort of a, I don't know if you want to call it a stalemate, but basically, and eventually a Nazi got stabbed in the back by one of the anarchists with a knife. And that is, well, I think the most violent left-wing deed in a while.
Yeah, he got, I think, 6 years.
Yeah, he got 6 years.
And there were also Nazis that was convicted for... They also injured some people, but not as seriously. So there were a number of Nazis that were jailed for rioting, basically. Most of them got a few months. I think one of them got like a year or so, but not very long time. And as we mentioned, one anti-fascist also got jail. So this occurred in 2013. So this was also like, it wasn't really, like, it wasn't as violent as other events, but it was also, like, very well known because it was, you know, Nazis attacking just ordinary people openly, like, in the middle of the day.
Yeah, because there weren't any anti-fascist action people there to begin with. They arrived after the Nazis attacked. They arrived a group of anti-fascist black blockers. So it was basically like the anti-fascist that stabbed the Nazi tried to claim self-defense in that sense, that they went there to protect the families, which is, you know, is admirable, but then again, he stabbed the Nazi in the back, so I don't...
Yeah, and Swedish self-defense law is quite restrictive.
Yeah.
You can only defend yourself. Like, you can, if someone attacks you and you beat them up really, really bad, that still counts as assault.
Yeah, it can do. We have some cases where we're called, we usually call it a violence of proportion.
Yeah.
Which is, and we also have, you know, the extent self-defense law, which means that you can self-defend for someone else. But the law is very restrictive in how you can act. Like, if you get hit by, let's say, a flagpole in the face, and let's say the Nazi turns away, and then you stab him in the back, that's not self-defense. You have to act on the immediate action that happens.
About that, like a year ago with ASAP Rocky.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just wanted to add, like, a lot of these members of NMR, like, NMR isn't an illegal organization, but basically expressing their beliefs openly is illegal. So you can't wear a swastika. That's considered a crime. And you can't, like, say that you want to hurt specific people. But you have to... So a lot of the time the Nazis just use slightly vague wordings to try to avoid getting caught. Yeah, but a lot of the time they also get convicted of a lot for what's called hets mot folkgrupp, which I think would be something like incitement against an ethnicity or people group in English. And so that's a sort of common crime that Nazis get sentenced for.
And they get sentenced for it a lot more about their online posts than actual demonstrations or protests. Like, you had a protest in Gothenburg where they got stormed by the police. They had permission to do the protest, but decided to go by the synagogue, which they weren't allowed to do by the cops. So the cops stormed them when they tried to make the turn for the synagogue. And that protest had banners that had specific political figures in them that they said they were going to hang. But they weren't charged for that because it wasn't enough for incitement. And so when they get charged for their online posts, just imagine what they're actually writing.
Yeah.
Because if you don't get charged for inciting hanging political opponents, it has to be kind of...
Like things like doing the Hitler salute, if you do it openly, that counts also as sort of incitement. And the Nordic resistance movement, they have also sort of appropriated a lot of Norse symbolism. So on their flags, their main symbol is the Tyr rune, which sort of, that symbol isn't Nazi-ish enough for it to be banned. But it still has, like, it was used by the Hitlerjugend, for example. And this is very common, also very annoying, that they tend to sort of appropriate Nordic symbolism and Nordic religion and, you know, try to make it into a Nazi thing.
Because they also say Hell Seger, which would be the Nordic equivalent of Sieg Heil, but Hell is a Norse word that basically means, what do you call it, high or something? A greeting word, basically.
Yeah, like it probably has the same roots as hello or something like that, but it's like very formal, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I just want to mention, because someone asked me that most people who are actually practice Norse religion aren't Nazis, and they strongly object to Nazis sort of using their symbolism, and it must be terrible to always get sort of lumped in with Nazis if you're interested in sort of Norse symbolism.
Yeah, Odinus, if you hear this, we love you. That's yeah. What I'm trying to say.
And unless you're Varg Vikernes.
Yeah, but, yeah, that guy.
That's another story. Yeah.
Yeah. It really is.
And even if like organized Nazism has been responsible for quite a bit of violence, they still are quite limited in numbers. I don't think they have ever like exceeded 1,000 people. No. And the biggest organization have been like 500 people. And as we mentioned before, they tend to break up and form new organizations when people start disagreeing with each other. But it's generally like the same people that just form new organizations. For example, there is an organization called Nordic Force or something like that, that recently broke out of Nordic Resistance Movement. But it's basically just the same people. However, the sort of radicalization has expanded online much more than sort of traditional Nazi movements. And the propagandists working online don't give orders or coordinate actions in the same way as organizations. But it can still be very dangerous, I think probably more dangerous than organized Nazism. And many far-right attacks in North America and around the world has been perpetrated by individuals who were basically radicalized on online forums and through online media.
Yep.
And an example of this could be, you know, Brandon Tarrant, the Christchurch shooter, for example, or the El Paso shooter.
And we have our own Swedish version of that.
Yeah.
Just less lethal. It's kind of hard. I don't like to label it as less lethal. But we have the Trollhättan shooting.
Or stabbing.
Stabbing. Sorry. The shooting was by the police. No. Yeah. Who was a guy radicalized online by forums like 4chan, stuff like that. I think most of you that listen to this have heard this story before. It's like you go through a radicalization process online where memes and dog whistling basically radicalizes you. So it's basically some kind of ironic Nazism. In a sense, that kind of pushes the boundaries for you. Eventually, you start to express these beliefs honestly. And he's kind of the poster child of this, in Sweden at least. You have several of these in the USA, of course.
He's probably one of the ones that, like, there was a lot of memery in the attack itself. That maybe the ordinary media didn't catch on to, and I didn't catch on to at first.
Dress up to the attack, which media claimed it to be some sort of Darth Vader-esque dress, but that was not what he was wearing. I think you can. If you search for Anton Lundin Pettersson, I think you can find the infamous picture of him. He's standing with his students.
A lot of people sort of label this at the beginning, like they thought of it more as a school shooting, where, you know, a former student shows up and he kills a bunch of people. And it's basically seen as, you know, an act of insanity. But like that wasn't really the case if you look into it, because he had never gone to this school. He didn't live in that area, but he had specifically targeted it because a lot of sort of immigrant kids and children of immigrants attended the school.
Yeah, and the dress he wore was something I picked up on immediately, because I'm a former Warhammer 40,000 player, so I collected Warhammer 40,000 figurines and stuff and painted them and stuff like that. And what he was dressed as was something that is called an Imperial Guard Steel Legion, which is a Warhammer 40K basically is a war game that you play, with figurines, and one of the races that you can play is, you know, human. And they have a subsection of an army that is called the Imperial Guard, which is basically just regular humans. And that army has certain factions within it. One of them is the Steel Legion, which is based on World War Two and One German soldiers in design. They look like they have the helmet of a World War Two soldier, and the trench coat and the gas mask of a World War One soldier from Germany. And they also like to have swords that he had. I think he had a saber, something like that. He had a knife too. And it was just, to me, it was kind of immediate what this was. This was clearly a call out to the Imperial Guard. And if you're gonna explain Warhammer 40K humans in a quick succession, it's basically that humanity within Warhammer 40K universe is not good. Like, it is not good because the idea of we playing a game and playing as humans means that we are good guys. In Warhammer 40K, that's not the case. Humanity is fascist, very much so. And part of it takes aesthetic of Soviets, and a part of it takes the aesthetics of Nazis in but basically the entirety of humanity is fascist and extremely xenophobic against other races in the universe. So when he shows that outfit, and I realized it, I contacted our main papers and got no response. They still went. And that's just not true. It, like, so I don't know if he deliberately didn't understand the situation, or, it's more click to write Darth Vader. But basically, Warhammer 40K is also a pretty common meme format for the far right, just because of these things. So they kind of use it all the time.
The attack basically started when he just walked into a school, which a lot of people might not, from other countries, like, they usually have guards at the entrances to schools, but we don't really have that in Sweden. So he just walked in. And since it was Halloween, a lot of people just thought it was someone, who decided to dress up for Halloween. So there were actually a few kids who are, white kids, who took a picture with him either before or after he had, like, killed people, because they thought, oh, hey, here's this guy who dressed up for Halloween, which is kind of, disturbing.
Yeah. We had a, I think that was one of the first photographs that surfaced on the media, when he took that photo with two girls and he holds the sword over his shoulder, which basically is the stance of a Imperial Guard officer. Like, there's so much with this that I want to reprimand media for, because it's not that hard to find this stuff. I even emailed them, as I said, like, no, you don't understand. He was way more radicalized than the media realized.
And I still don't really think that this was... It maybe like later on people called it like a terrorist attack or something like that, but it's still just, you know, it's a school attack. It's what people usually call it. But he specifically wanted to target, you know, immigrants or those he saw as immigrants.
Yeah, and he did suicide by cop. Like, yeah. That was also deliberate, because he assaulted... If I remember correctly, there was one cop that went in and he met him in the stairs, I think. And when he saw the cop, he raised his sword and charged. So the cop fired off his weapon. So basically, he knew damn well what he was doing.
Yeah, so, he even wrote to other people online that, I hope I don't survive. I hope they aim, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think that media failed to report this, because, as you say, people say that this is a regular school attack, but it was not. It's not a story of revenge. It's a story of ideology.
Yeah, and like, not to defend media too much, but like, it's also kind of difficult if you're not super into online culture. But there are a lot of things that it may be difficult to understand if you're not, you know, if you don't know. I had no idea, for example, about the Warhammer 40K stuff. I thought, you know, Darth Vader or something like that, you know.
No. I understand that. So I don't want to slam media too much, but it had also been no new things about that.
If they had done a thing like, you know, we were wrong about this, here's the updated information, that would have been fine, right?
Yeah, but that has never come, as I know. Maybe in a documentary or something like that, but it's not been highlighted enough. The problem here is that this is a guy, he's not radicalized by our Nazi organizations or anything. He's radicalized online.
Yeah, YouTuber he liked to watch was, for example, the Golden One is called.
Yeah.
Which is, he is quite an open fascist, I think. But he has also kind of, you know, he's kind of seen as a sort of ironic guy. That sort of preaches fascism, but also does a bunch of bodybuilding, and he looks kind of silly.
The Golden One is mostly mostly seen as harmless, mostly because I don't think, like, I don't want to be nice to him because he's still an asshole, but he's like, he seems really tame. In a sense, like, very humble.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't ask for race war. He doesn't want to kill people.
Yeah, and I think that's why he had managed to stay on, like, YouTube.
Yeah.
Because he isn't like that. And that was the kind of thing that actually showed up in newspapers, like, a few days after, that they brought up, you know, he followed these and these YouTubers and followed these websites and, you know, and there you also see, like, okay, some of them, I get why. And then they also brought up, like for example, the Amazing Atheist. Like, he's an asshole, but I don't think, like, he had that much to do with it.
No, he's just...
But they still mentioned him in a newspaper because, you know, the journalist maybe didn't really know that much about him. So.
So when... In retrospective, when things like this happens, and it goes to not just Swedish media, but all media, is try to contact someone that has a clue. Because it gets really stupid if you say like, yeah, he watched Ben Shapiro and the Golden One, and also he watched PewDiePie. Like, yeah PewDiePie is not going to make a Nazi. Just like, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, then you end up kind of sounding just silly and sort of destroying your own argument. So that's,
I think that's like, if you bring up the amazing atheist of T.J. Kirk, as his name is, what he, I don't know, he has done a lot other than being a dick. Like, he's not even the worst skeptic out there. It's like, ooh. If you bring up Sargon of Akkad, we're talking another level. But it's really, so it this really got swept under, was swept under the rug, in the sense that it was a school attack, bad that it happened, but we didn't really reflect on it a lot. Yeah. Yeah. We kind of know that one of these attacks inspire other people into committing violence. Usually, like in America, when there is a school shooting, there is not one school shooting. There is usually, you know, one goes off and then another one goes off and then another one goes off. It kind of encourages other people to do, which is why it's important to report on these cases accurately.
Yeah. And also, like, when you bring up school shootings, like, for example, Columbine, people have recently started, you know, looking back and looking at, like, these guys were, you know, they were big fans of Hitler. And maybe, you know, the attacks wasn't just because of, you know, things that got blamed, like video games and Marilyn Manson and things like that.
But yeah. Yeah, it's been just recently started to realize real motivations behind it, what can only be described otherwise as senseless violence. And that is kind of terrifying that we don't practice better, actually.
And I one interesting thing I want to bring up just before we end is that, like, it is a very common tactic of the far right to act not in group but alone, like in this school attack, for example, or Breivik.
Yeah,
and it's actually called leaderless resistance, and it's a deliberate tactic because the newspapers sometimes they literally say lone wolf. They don't as often anymore, I think, but, you know, it still happens because...
Yeah, it also happened in the bombs in Gothenburg. What happened there, before we end, is that you had three people from the resistance movement leaving the NR just prior to the attack. So when they left the bombs and were arrested, there was no ties back to the NMR. So the NMR was basically not responsible for the attack anymore because they weren't in the organization. But that is probably just a tactic, just to not sink the movement, so to speak. Like, we're going to do a bomb attack. All right, just resign from these organizations before you do it. And they did it. And then it was like, no. And NMR can say, just like, we didn't do it. They weren't members of our organizations. So they get away with it, basically.
Yeah. And I think we have to start wrapping up here. We discussed for a while. I just want to mention, I don't think I did, that three people, except for the assailant, died. One student was 15, I think, and one 20-year-old teacher assistant and one teacher were killed by the attack. Yeah, so I think that's pretty much it, really, until today in terms of political violence by the far right. I want to thank you very much for joining me, Todor. And do you want to plug anything?
Not really. I'm kind of low on content right now, so... I want to thank you for letting me on. It's an interesting subject, and I think we covered a lot today, actually.
Yeah, it's more than, I think, twice or more than that, the length of my other episode. So I got a lot of editing to look forward to.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I also want to mention, if you want to learn more about, you know, far-right attacks and, you know, their tactics, Kathleen Ballou, an American scholar, has a book called Bring the War Home. I haven't read it, but I've heard good stuff about it. So if you want to know more about it, maybe you should pick it up.
Oh, yeah. I should also plug the book, what is it called? The White Nation State and the Proud Boys, which is a really good book on American far-right extremism and how that plays out in real life.
So thank you very much, and I hope you like the episode. We'll see what we'll do the next time, but please make sure to share the episode on social media or get in touch if you have any ideas for future episodes, and I'll see you next time. Goodbye.